So, look, again, these are just all the thinnest small straws in the wind, but nonetheless, they were there. And perhaps most seriously, though, to suggest that it wasn't just simply a case of a few outlying incidents. Though, although this is still unconfirmed, but nonetheless, sources apparently told the emigre news outlet Wiorstka that, nationally speaking, in polling, the party's ratings had risen to 9.3%. Again, that's, I think it's worth stressing, that's not so much 9.3% for Jabloko. It's that Jabloko had emerged as a vessel for all kinds of anti-war, anti-Kremlin, and indeed economic grievances. And this clearly worried the presidential administration and the Kremlin, with very good reason. Now, various theories have abounded as to why Jabloko was then banned. Some say it was the sort of security bloc overruling Kirienko. I really don't think that's the case. Some saying that there was a fear that its vote share would eat into Rodina's. Well, look, if you can find people who are, A, interested in supporting an ultra-nationalist pro-war party, but would be seduced by Jabloko, I think you've got some very, very confused electors. No, I think it's really what it seems to have been, which is precisely that the presidential administration and the Kremlin, having originally thought that this was a safe way of discharging unresolved oppositionist potential, decided actually to pull the plug now to avoid this from getting out of hand. The journalist Mikhail Zigar claimed that both Kirienko and the FSB advocated this and that Putin had the final say. And frankly, that sounds right to me. So, Jabloko is off the ballot. Because there was never any question of it beating United Russia or even the Communist Party. But the fear is that it was catalysing, in a way, the same sort of force that Navalny had appealed to, what I've called the coalition of the fed up. A whole bunch of different people with different social origins, different regional identities, different grievances. But that sense of, if you want to be able to express the view that you're sick of it and you want things to change, then you find something to which you can, in a way, adhere yourself to, even if only temporarily. And this coalition of the fed up is what was now beginning to cohere around Jabloko. And if that had been allowed to continue, well, look, there's still another almost 6 weeks for Jabloko's momentum to have grown. And above all, for there to be meetings and petitions and online events and so forth, all of which allows people to connect, people to realise that they're not alone. Grigory Yavlinsky, the founder of Jabloko, presented the campaign as actually specifically not being about breaking into the Duma, but just simply creating a space in which Russians could legally and openly express anti-war sentiment. One of the whole points of these elections is that they are legitimating rituals to give the impression that mass consensus is behind the Kremlin, to, in effect, encourage the unhappy to think that they must just simply be the only people who think the way they think, to feel vulnerably isolated, and to shut the hell up. Well, anything that creates these kind of horizontal ties amongst people who have scepticism, criticism, outright opposition to the Kremlin is dangerous as a result. Atomization and apathy are, after all, the greatest weapons of this system. And look, even if Jabloko had polled or had been allowed to get more than 5%, you know, letting someone into the Duma, on one level, that would have been irrelevant. One, two, three, five deputies in a Duma packed with not just United Russia, but all the other fake oppositionists. No big deal. More to the point, the sight of a party which had polled less than 2% last time round, more than doubling its share and crossing not just the 5% threshold, but also embarrassingly the 3% so that it would be getting state funding, would be deeply embarrassing given its explicitly anti-war, anti-authoritarian message. However, simply letting them stand and fixing the vote to keep them out, that also had risks. Remember, this is, for me, one of the most fascinating aspects of this. You know, we think of these as rigged elections, and they are going to be rigged elections. But the political technologists want to have to rig it as little as possible. The bigger the gap, the bigger the gap between the real vote and what people feel is the real vote and the announced one, firstly, the less effective it is in legitimating the regime. Quite the opposite, it can actually flip the other way round. But also, the more likely it is to trigger more direct opposition. I mean, remember, the Bolotnaya protests, of which more later, the big protests from 2011 to 2013, biggest protests we've seen in post-Soviet times, they were triggered again by a sense that an election had been stolen. So this is one of the reasons why, in effect, the presidential administration, as far as possible, pre-rigs the vote. It excludes candidates who it thinks it's going to be dangerous. It builds up momentum behind its various fake opposition parties. It blackens the name of its rivals, etc., in order to try and shrink the gap that it's going to need to rig the vote by. So, at the moment, Yabloko is now off the ballot. It is appealing the case. Its appeal is actually going to be heard in the Supreme Court tomorrow. I'm recording this on Sunday, the 16th of August, so it's going to be on the Monday. And it's threatening that it'll even take this to the Constitutional Court, if need be. So there is some scope. Again, you know, sometimes the presidential administration's boys like to manufacture a certain amount of dramaturgia, a certain theatricality. So, you know, it is possible that we will see there an appeal being upheld at some stage, allowing the Kremlin to trumpet that this demonstrates just how democratic and law-based the system is and so forth. However, I suspect not. I don't think that at the moment the Kremlin is in a mood to take risks. I think it is defaulting to the simpler and more heavy-handed tactics. Yabloko leader Nikolai Rybakov has called for calm. He said that holding protests, quote, is dangerous for participants. I ask you not to give in to provocations and to continue supporting us in other ways, comments, publications, volunteering, donations, other legal and safer ways. I have a suspicion that he, again, not without reason, fears provocations. Fears precisely that the security forces will try to make Yabloko look as if it's dangerously unstable. So, I mean, look, as I've said in a Twitter feed, this is clearly bad news, but it is, on the other hand, an interesting data point in support of the notion that there is actually a substantial portion of the electorate fed up with the war, but also fed up with the status quo generally. And this inevitably even causes some concerns within the elite. Not everyone is happy with the idea of Yabloko being banned. I mean, again, very much on the local level, but already we've had the heads of the Communist Party and a Just Russia in the Vladimir region criticising the disqualification of Yabloko. The communist leader in Vladimir. Certainly this is not something we'd expect to hear from Zyuganov, who is, you know, essentially bought and paid for by Kiryenko. Anyway, the communist leader Anton Sidorko said, "Elections have long ceased to be a competition of ideologies, programs and personalities. Parties and candidates unpopular with the authorities are now simply removed from the elections on legal grounds that are literally far-fetched." Well, yes, comrade, that is indeed the way the system works. But the thing is, this is not going to just simply go away. Because, as I say, it wasn't really about Yabloko. Yabloko was just simply the vessel into which people were pouring some, what turns out to be unrealistic hopes that they would have the chance to express their views. We're going to see this bubble forth in all sorts of other different ways. I mean, just again, a little side note. It's funny how apples have already become symbols, sometimes with unexpected results. Tomorrow isn't just the day of the appeal hearing, but also it's the Orthodox feast of the Transfiguration of the Lord, popularly known as the Apple Saviour. So in Chita, in Transbaikalia, the Transbaikal Metropolitanate of the Russian Orthodox Church and the regional branch of the Young Guard of United Russia, so essentially United Russia's Komsomol, you know, Young Communist League equivalent, so it's very, very Putinite movement. Anyway, they have long planned, and we'll be having to go ahead with, the distribution of blessed apples in Cheetah and the surrounding region. So already we've got some wags on social media spinning this as, you know, entirely mischievously, as a sign of secret support for Yablaka. Now, of course it's not. But I think if we can expect everything, even potentially Apple-related, to become politically symbolic now, between now and the elections. And this is going to be noticed, because the Kremlin, as I said, is scared not so much of Yablaka, but of the latent protest potential that it was channeling. That sense that there is, within Russia, a bunch of people who are just looking for, I hesitate to say a saviour, but, you know, but something that will allow them to feel part of something bigger and express their opposition to what's going on. The Kremlin, after all, is very scared, frankly, of letting this become an open confrontation. It is still living under the shadow of the Bolotnaya protests, and also of its own fears of Western Gibridnaya Voyna. Remember at this point that hybrid warfare, this is meant to be this terrible Russian threat to the West. I mean, yes, it is a challenge, but how far it's a threat, well, that's really up to us. But anyway, the Russians are the ones who actually think that this is the West's tool, that it is the West that is particularly adept and eager to use the dark arts of subversion and opening fissure lines within society and so forth to bring down regimes it doesn't like. This is one of the things that was scared Putin about Bolotnaya. He felt that it was, in a way, the West or the Americans and the Brits finally coming for him, one of the reasons for his particular crackdown thereafter. So in those contexts, given the paranoias of the Kremlin, this clearly is something that is going to worry it. And, well, while I'm mentioning Bolotnaya, let's think of the past and past parallels. So after the break, I'm going to do that through the medium of looking at, again, another recent book that is worth discussing for a while. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counterterrorism, and civil affairs. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/InMoscowShadows. And remember that patrons, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian, get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, including articles I've written, the most weekly Govorit Moskva press briefing, and other bonus content like the Chronicles of a Different Russia Alternative Histories. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galeotti or on Facebook, Mark Galeotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. So, as I said, what I'm going to do now is look at a recent book and consider also what it can say about the dilemmas of opposition politics in Putin's Russia today. Before I do, just a quick note. I mean, again, as I imagine you can, you know, as I presume that you would assume, I read a lot of books about Russia. And I often like to, again, on the whole, I only raise the ones that I think are interesting or important. I don't generally say, you know, talk about books that I think are just not so good or mediocre. Occasionally I will slam a book when I actually think it is particularly poor or particularly problematic. But I do so in the context of trying to sort of connect it to wider discussions rather than just a straightforward book review, because I think there's a lot of those around. I would be curious about how you, the listeners, and particularly if you're patrons, and as ever, if you are a listener but not a patron, spare a little thought and blessing for those people who actually free up the time for me to make these podcasts for you. Anyway, if you think this works, if you like this, or if you frankly just don't really want to hear about books, because I'm not going to do just boring, straightforward reviews. So it's a question of whether I do this kind of blended approach or not. So let me know. Anyway, the book in question is Mikhail Fishman's book, The Successor, Boris Nemtsov, Vladimir Putin, and the Decline of Modern Russia, which came out this year, 2026, by Pushkin Press. It was originally published in Russian. You'd be very surprised to hear, I'm sure, that it's actually very hard to find in Russia these days, and it's now been translated by Michelle Birdie. And look, it's a massive brick of a book. I've got an uncorrected proof version that's a mere 762 pages long. And it doesn't have an index, which is a bit of a problem we're using it. But anyway, the index is only going to expand it further. And thus, given its size, perhaps rather fittingly, I can't help but think that it's really two books in one. Ostensibly, it's a biography of Boris Nemtsov, the charismatic, liberal physicist-turned-politician whose career spanned, well, in a way, he got into activist politics even in the dying days of the Soviet Union. But anyway, he was very active in the late Yeltsin era, deputy prime minister. He was co-founder of the Union of Right Forces Party. And then ultimately, he was tragically gunned down by Chechens on Moscow's Bolshoi Moskvoretsky Bridge in February of 2015, while trying to sort of basically mobilize opposition to what was happening in the Donbass and Russia's intervention of that, and indeed annexation of Crimea. So the book is about Nemtsov, but in many ways, really, it's an incredibly detailed recounting of the politics of the 1990s and the 2000s, especially, but by no means exclusively, from, I think it's fair to say, the liberal side of the political spectrum. While he's now in exile in the Netherlands, Fishman was a former editor-in-chief of the Moscow Times. He was an anchor for the independent TV network TV Rain, Dojd. And frankly, he was a political, a fixture, I would say, of the political scene in those times. So Fishman very, very much has the inside knowledge to pack this tome. Now, to talk about this as a book, or again, two books, a biography and a political biography, shall we say, before I spin out some of the wider issues it raises, I think I must confess that it does one of these things a lot better than the other. As an inside account of the political shenanigans, the ins and outs, the personalities, the rivalries of the times, it is very rich and incredibly detailed. I mean, there were all sorts of developments, especially in the 1990s, that I confess I had, I wouldn't necessarily say forgotten, but at least let slip further back in my mind, from the baleful influence of Yeltsin's former chief bodyguard, Alexander Korshakov, thoroughly unpleasant individual, to squabbles over assets like the Avtovaz car manufacturer. And as I say, Fishman has the inside gen, absolutely. But he does seem determined to give us all of it. All of it. We are so deep in the weeds, you lose sight of the sky at times. There's less of a sense of the big picture than just simply this unrelenting flow of stuff happening. As a source book on the times, it's absolutely invaluable. As a read, I'm not quite so sure. Now, again, there's so much good stuff in this, it's worth noting. I mean, if I start plucking out particular plums, then I risk being here all day. But let me just give one example. Now, Fishman is especially good around the rise of Putin, particularly from, I'd say, kind of an outsider's perspective, since, you know, I think, again, Fishman's strength is really on the sort of liberal side of the political divide rather than the inside machinations of the so-called family, the people who were closest to Yeltsin at the time. Still, he recounts a couple of nice lines about this. One of them is when Putin had been picked as Yeltsin's successor. And it's worth noting that Nemtsov, even though at times people had thought of him in that role, nonetheless, he supported Yeltsin's Yeltsin's choice of Putin. But then Boris told Tolya, that's Anatoly Chubais, the figure most closely associated with the privatization campaigns of the 1990s. You'll have trouble with him. But apparently Chubais thought Putin could be educated and that it was possible to work with him. Now, I thought this was interesting because it really encapsulates both the naivete of many who really, in a way, were taken in by this notion of Putin as the self-effacing factotum, everyone's favourite bagman, because that's how he'd risen. Whether it was in St. Petersburg working for Sobchak, whether it was then coming to Moscow, the Presidential Property Directorate, he was everyone's favourite aide-de-camp, the person who would keep the boss insulated from all their corrupt deals, would fix whatever needed to be fixed, would just simply ensure that everything kept working without in any way looking like a political threat. Of course, once Putin's behind the big desk, he's much less inclined to be submissive. So that's one thing. But also this patronising attitude. Putin could be educated. The sense that this provincial could be house-trained. I mean, I think that's something that Putin realised only too well and must absolutely have resented. Remember, this is a man who is not averse, shall we say, to taking revenge, even if it's a very cold dish. But anyway, at the time, the oligarchs and the 90s generation politicians didn't really realise the threat that they were in or that they were actually creating for themselves. And they were instead way too busy fighting amongst each other. And again, it's a nice passage from Kommersant that Fishman quotes. Chubais wants to jail Korshakov. Korshakov wants to jail Gusinski. All of them want to jail Potanin. Berezovsky and Abramovich want to see Chubais behind bars. And Gusinski, Primakov and Lushkov want to jail Berezovsky. Yeah, everyone is looking to basically take down their enemies. I'm trying to think, is it the usual suspects? I'm trying to think, there is one particular Quentin Tarantino film. Oh, is it Reservoir Dogs, where basically, you know, pretty much at the end, everyone in a Mexican standoff shoots everyone else. And one, I think it's Mr. Pink. Anyway, you know, the one survivor picks up the bag of diamonds and scurries out. Well, I have a slight sense almost that that's also the story of Putin, that all of the people who were that much more powerful, arguably, in non-institutional ways, were so busy fighting amongst themselves that they allowed Putin to pick up the diamonds. So, lots and lots of fascinating political insights. But as a book about Nemtsov as a person, I can't help but feel that this book is much less compelling. Nemtsov is a character in the story rather than the character. Fishman doesn't seem to want to talk about Nemtsov as a person, but just as a political actor. We hear again and again that he's charismatic, curly-haired and a hit with the ladies. That he can't help saying what he thinks. Okay, fine, but that's a cameo, not a character. He's present in body throughout this book, but I did feel his spirit was somewhat absent. Though, again, there are all sorts of nice vignettes, like I did love the one about him being asked for a selfie by one of the investigators who was searching his flat in 2012 as things are getting seriously tough for him. But there's no sense of the heart, no real theme, just lots of stuff happening. Now, I imagine it certainly wasn't the intent behind the book, but if anything, I've got to confess, I actually finished it less impressed with Nemtsov the man. His heart was often, though not always, in the right place, and his spirit and courage absolutely unquestionable. But I did end up, I don't know, undefinably disappointed in him. Maybe seeing him at times as a poor politician, frankly, who was coasting on the social capital he'd made in the 1990s and his undoubted capacity to generate new social connections, but who ultimately wasn't able to turn that into something tangible and effective. Despite the book's title, and indeed the fact that Yeltsin often called Nemtsov my successor as president, he never really had a chance of being a successor and to take Russia in a different direction. And so, in some ways, I actually feel that he shone most. Well, firstly, when he was helping organise things like Bolotna, by which time he was no longer in the front rank of the opposition figures. A new generation, Navalny, Udaltsov, Yashin and so forth, had really emerged. But nonetheless, again, using that both experience but also social capital, Nemtsov did indeed play an absolutely crucial role behind the scenes in actually just getting it all together. Just the practicalities, the nuts and bolts, knowing how you bring together massive demos. But beyond that, I mean, I think he shone not as Deputy Prime Minister in 97 to 98, not as Governor of Nizhny Novgorod in 91-7, nor even actually as the leading light of the Union of Right Forces or its later sort of kind of successor, Parnas, but actually as a member of the Yaroslavl Regional Duma from 2013, you know, a local parliament. But then, you know, perhaps chastened by his years in the wilderness, he really threw himself into local politics and administration and debates, the kind of grassroots politics and administration that Russia so often lacks, and yet which arguably creates the the unshowy, undramatic, but absolutely essential building blocks for genuine change, rather than just chanting slogans at a rally. I don't know, as I said, it feels terribly mean-spirited to say anything negative, really, about him, but especially considering what happened to him. And this is not a final judgment. It's just my kind of gut sense on closing this book and trying desperately how to work out how to find a large enough space on the bookshelves for it. But anyway, let me look at the relevance of Nemtsov and Fishman's portrait of the time and the resonance to the present day. There was something that Navalny said to Nemtsov that struck with me, that he was essentially associated with the 1990s. And separately, it is worth noting that although Nemtsov didn't have anything really to do with the privatization that allowed a handful of Russians to become obscenely rich through taking state assets for kopecks on the ruble. Although Nemtsov, Fishman says, does become quite rich through investments, though he rather skates over quite what this was. And I must admit, I would have appreciated more on this, just to get a sense of, was there anything, to be blunt, was there anything shady and insider dealing about that or not? But anyway, he wasn't behind the privatisation campaign. But the trouble is, the privatisation campaigns have become so radioactive, so toxic for most Russians, that just generally his role as being a key figure in the politics of the times, his closeness to figures like Chubais and the oligarchs, inevitably mean that he's been tarred with the same brush. The thing is, you can't outrun your history. There's only a limit to how far you can reinvent yourself. And frankly, it gets harder to reinvent yourself if you are honest. And this helps explain, I would suggest, why today so many expat politicians are not coming out wholeheartedly, as some would want, in support of Ukraine. I mean, there are some who do, like Garry Kasparov, but frankly, he has no real traction inside Russia. And this is thrown into sharp relief by an interesting recent debate between Ilya Yashin, now in the West, who had been Nemtsov's right-hand man and campaign manager, and Nigel Gould Davis of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. In The Spectator, Gould Davis had written, "For all its genuine antipathy to Putin and suffering at his hands, much of Russia's exiled opposition still seems to prioritize in its activities and lobbying the protection of Russia's people and assets. This is because it hopes one day to govern Russia. Europe's priority is different. To end the war on terms that prevent Russia mounting a future threat, this should serve the opposition's goals too. Will it gain the moral clarity to see this?" Well, it's always a bit tricky when foreigners are basically telling people who have faced genuine serious repression at the hands of the Kremlin how they ought to be protesting against it and how they ought to be feeling. And in the Moscow Times, Yashin replied, particularly addressing the demand for more sanctions, more exclusions of Russians from Europe, like, for example, Germany's decision to suspend its humanitarian visa program for anti-war Russians and Belarusian opposition activists, arguing, quote, "On the point that the Russian democratic opposition places the interests of the Russian people above all else, Gould Davis is absolutely right. I can confirm that for my colleagues in the Peaceful Russia Party and me, the interests of our people are indeed our highest priority. Otherwise, we would have no right to call ourselves Russian politicians." And he goes on then to say, "Would it not be wiser then to build constructive relations with that part of Russian society that is capable of creating such a country? Would it not be wiser to regard us as allies and extend a hand to us? Would it not be wiser to support us, strengthening our position and improving our chances of shaping Russia's future?" And Gould Davis's riposte, also in Moscow Times, I promise it's the last chunky quote, "This Soviet intelligentsia," he's talking about the dissident movement back in the late Soviet times, "saw itself as a moral conscience rather than as a group of politicians in waiting. Its principled position was that Soviet power must be weakened and isolated in order for the regime to change, was also strategically vindicated. Within a decade of the Afghan invasion, the communist system was headed towards collapse." Well, first of all, and this is a particular bugbear point of mine, Afghanistan did not bring down the Soviet Union. Soviet Union was brought down by A, the intrinsic contradictions in this system that just simply had basically run out of capacity to modernize and be productive, and also Gorbachev's quixotic attempt to reform it, always the most dangerous moment of trying to reform an authoritarian system. Arguably, if we'd instead just simply got a fairly clear-sighted conservative committed to holding the system together, Soviet Union would have lasted a hell of a lot longer. I still imagine it would have been by now long since gone, but it certainly would not have collapsed at the end of 1991. So to draw that comparison, correlation is not causation. Afghanistan didn't bring down the Soviet Union. The Cold War arguably absolutely contributed much more directly. I mean, it also bankrupted the United States, but that's a whole separate issue. But you know, ultimately what it comes down to is this idea of, is it more important just to collapse the system, or is it more important to try and change the system? Because in a way, the Yashin argument is, help us change the system. The Gould Davis argument is, crash the system and then change is inevitable. Look, there is a hell of a lot more to this debate. I have only really picked out certain elements. My apologies to both Yashin and Gould Davis for all the elements that I didn't cover. And if you feel that I have misrepresented your views, frankly, I encourage people to go and read this debate for themselves. And I'll leave links to those three pieces in the program notes. But I thought there was this crucial point of, in some ways, dissident versus politician. The thing is, dissidents are essentially creatures of moral rather than political authority. Dissidents do not expect or indeed plan to come to power. They're more concerned with saying, I will not accept this, I will not be part of this, I will not keep quiet about this. Politicians still hope to come to power. They hope to actually be the change, not just witness it. Navalny was not a dissident, in my opinion, in the classic Soviet sense. Instead, he was a politician. He was an opposition activist. He didn't just simply say, I will not accept this system. He actively sought to change it. So a couple of points that connect this back to Nemtsov and his example. First of all, that history neither forgets nor forgives. The Soviet dissidents who supported sanctions and more, in some ways, well, I mean, some of them did end up being to a slight degree discredited, but on the whole, they were okay. They have still had their place within what we could think of as Russia's moral pantheon, because Russia is a different country, and because they did not seek political power. They were not trying to crash the Soviet system because they saw an opportunity for themselves. Again, this is why Lenin was not a dissident, but an oppositionist. Nemtsov was not forgiven the government's sins of the 1990s, and perhaps would not have been forgiven his stance on Ukraine. I'm not sure, but I think it's certainly clear that if he was around today, he would probably have been, again, supporting this line that anything that allows Ukraine to beat Russia in the hope that that weakens the regime enough to bring it down is a good thing. And that may well have counted against him if he was still around. I definitely think that the emigres today calling for Russia to lose, in effect cheering on Ukrainian attacks, and thus in effect welcoming Russian casualties, are not going to be forgiven. Yes, defeating Ukraine might contribute to ending the system. Maybe. I mean, let's not assume that there's going to be necessarily a direct connection there. But, you know, on the whole, a genuine defeat, which is not the same as just basically calling a stop to the war, holding on to the 20% of Ukraine you've got and then starting negotiations. But a genuine retreat, that absolutely would be a humiliation and might well be an existential blow for the Putin system. But A, it's not likely to happen. And B, ending the system is not necessarily a good thing. However ghastly the Putin system, late Putinism may be, there are worse things around. In fact, after all, collapsing systems can in fact be a very negative thing. Even if we set aside the fall of Weimar Germany and Hitler's rise to power, you know, one can't bring everything back to Germany and Hitler. There's a host of other examples, whether we're talking about, I don't know, Bolivia's devastating defeat against Paraguay in the Chaco War that led to the rise of military dictatorship, to arguably defeat in World War I, ultimately opening the way to Bolshevik authoritarianism in Russia. You know, collapse can be a catalyst for bad things happening. The rise of someone who promises simple, easy, and quite possibly violent solutions. So I would say that Nemtsov's example shows that, again, through the effect of the 1990s, the degree to which one has to think, how are the choices I'm making today, the company I keep today, and the statements and policy platforms that I present today going to be interpreted in the future? And then we come back to this whole issue of, was Nemtsov a dissident or a politician? I think it's a really interesting question, and one that I don't think he was ever really certain about in his mind. I mean, reading this book, I felt that this was a man who set out to be a politician, but who had the soul of a dissident. He was an idealist in a ruthlessly pragmatic world, in a way that Navalny, for example, was not. And I say that... Zoals het zand tot spiegels werd uit het niets gelijk. De homunculus. Het kind buiten de moeder, kind uit de moeder. Zoals hij. Toralba en Gauricus. Toralba, Gauricus. Maar Zweden borg al voor Stockholm voorbij. Om achter zich de vlammen te zien van een catastrofe in zijn gedachten. Zoals ook de homunculus werd het kind buiten de moeder, kind uit de moeder. Zoals hij.
En daar zitten ze, de duivel en Tlazolteol, koningin van de Sabbat, gekroond als koningen, koninginnen die op aarde sterven in geld en marmelade. Prinsen en prinsessen wier pruiken groeien in de vlammen van het brandend kruis. Daar zit hij, de duivel wiens kont is gelikt en die zich nu te goed doet aan het vlees van verkoolde kinderen. En voor zijn troon dansen en zingen heksen te zijner ere.
Voor hen die van ver kwamen en nieuw zijn, de nieuwgekomenen. Alegremos, que gente nueva tenemos, alegremos.
En dan wijken allen voor hem. Welkom in de naam van Satan en zijn volgeling. In stilte stijgen ze af, als ze kwamen op bokken die langs maan en nevelvlek hun weg vonden naar hier. Dan lopen ze langzaam in een rij naar het gevallen kruis en vertrappen het in afschuw en woede. In hun weelderige gewaden naderen ze nu de troon van de kwade monarch die opstaat en zijn hand heft. Men knielt en wacht. De vrouwen met lange rokken van welstand en adel besmeurd met modder en mos. Heren die in het achterland paraderen als God en Gabriel en nu wachten op het doopsel van de duivel. In hun gevouwen handen bieden zij ziel en zaligheid. Ze worden tot dienaar. En dan is het moment gekomen dat ze hun nette kleren afdoen. Alles voor Satan. Schamel en naakt, maar in uiterste vervoering zijn ze tot alles in staat. Ze kussen eerbiedig zijn billen. Dan breekt de hel los. Ze worden gillend omringd door toekijkende trollen, kollen en kobolten. De heksen krijzen en dansen. Wij dansen, schreeuwen, splijten de aarde. Onophoudelijk tot schuimens toe, geverfd in felle kleuren, zweven wij elkaar op en werpen rook en vuur. We scheuren de nevels aan flarden en stijgen. We stijgen, wij stijgen in cirkels en spiralen door lovertakken, spinrag, terwijl raven en nachtvlinders ons omringen en leiden tot boven boomtoppen en torenspitsen. In een roes van spattend hellevuur verlaten wij de heuvel, naar boven, naar Zenith en Zodiac, naar hel en duivel. Wij, Taralba en Gauricus, Tlazolteo, Paramon, Liva en Anvernos. Condori! en nu achtergebleven, zet zich na de schouw tot het voorbereiden van sagen en legenden. Het afschrikwekkend voorbeeld voor een volk in het achterland. De wind verstuift het zand en bedekt de sporen van Satans foze volgelingen die wachten op de avond.
Yeah, welcome to another edition of our radio Patapus. If we get from working somehow. You were just listening to Boudewijn de Groot from his album Nacht en Ontij. Was that the track? Nacht en Ontij from Holland 1968. About a witch's Sabbath. From Germany now, Kalakakra, from the album Crawling to Lhasa, is this nearby Shiraz.
Ich am Leben ist, mich.
Kalakakra was that from her album Crawling to Lhasa, a very rare German private pressing from the 70s that was nearby Shiraz. Now let's continue with from England, a bit more contemporary, another private pressing on the White Rabbit Records from the debut album of Beggar's Farm. It's called